I gave a site update for SMA, and I'm going to go into a little more detail at this point. I just want to point out that I came to the EHT because I was hired to do digital signal processing, specifically the correlator at SMA. SMA's VLBI capability was talked about when it was conceptualized, but it was de-scoped because of funding reasons. It's the same thing that happened to Elmer. So anyway, so back in 2006, Shep was looking to augment his ragtag bag of ruffians, and I joined the team at that point to represent SMA. So SMA currently uses an ASIC board. This is actually an ASIC correlator board designed at MIT Haystack, and it has 32 of these ASIC correlator chips on it. And there's roughly 100 of them in the SMA correlator system. And it's a very highly parallel correlator and what they used to call a hybrid correlator. And it's hybrid in the sense that it's preceded by a filter bank. And this here is one of the filter bank and digitizer components. And each one of these channels is a block of digitized bandwidth. And each of those blocks is 82 megahertz. So it actually turns out that to cover 4 gigahertz of SMA bandwidth, SMA was originally a 2 gigahertz dual polarization. Now it can do 4 gigahertz in a single pole or 2 gigahertz in 2 gigahertz. You have to divide that band up into, let's just talk about the 4 gigahertz band, 48 little analog channels independently processed. And don't forget that we have 8 antennas, so it turns out you have 384 independent analog channels and digitizers and so forth. Just highly hybridized. It actually, and every one of those channels needs local oscillators and mixers and filters and a lot of cables, and it gets terribly unwieldy and terribly unreliable. And I vaguely remember that there was a team of about 7 technicians working for about a decade putting this whole IFLO system together. And that's the motivation for higher and higher performance digital signal processing. And I also showed this in the update, and I'm just going to kind of skip over the receivers, which is not my work, but it seems like we're getting to a point where we have 8 gigahertz. I mean, things get a little worse here, but 4 to 12 gigahertz of IF bandwidth. And that's only a single sideband, and it's only a single polarization. So if you have a dual pole system with 8 gigahertz in each sideband times dual polarization, that's 32 gigahertz of bandwidth. That's a 128 gigabit per second system. So basically, the point is that the EHT's bandwidth and hence its sensitivity is limited by really not by the receivers, but by the digital signal processing, in a sense. And I include recording in that, although I'm not really going to talk about recording. Speaking to people at the conference here, a lot of people hadn't really heard of CASPER, the Collaboration for Astronomy Signal Processing and Electronics Research. And Laura covered some of this, and I just want to give a little bit of a glossary. I mean, CASPER is a digital signal processing, a global digital signal processing collaboration started by Dan Wertheimer at UC Berkeley, and also the late Don Backer, who was a huge friend of CASPER. The idea is that these digital backends for radio astronomy telescopes end up being huge projects that take much longer than people want them to take. So you think of a telescope, and then you think that you need a correlator for it, and you know, maybe a decade if you're lucky, possibly 15 years later, then you have a correlator. So if we can only share technologies and make things general purpose, we can do things faster. So this is just a glossary. There's something called ROCH, the Reconfigurable Open Architecture Computing Hardware. That's a bit of a distasteful acronym, but some people think, but I find that it's best to embrace it, and hence the logo, and the 1U enclosure is colloquially the ROCH Motel. And there's also a variety of analog to digital converters, rather high performance ones in our case. We actually at SMA and EHT are the people in CASPER who are really chasing bandwidth. If you look more broadly, the world is full of rather lower bandwidth telescopes that have many more elements. If you think of SKA as 1,000 thousands of elements. Meerkat has 64, ALMA does have a bunch. We're the ones who are really the ones that our antennas have rather, we have rather fewer elements in our interferometers, but we are chasing bandwidth. And there's a quick mission statement over there. So this is what the Roach block diagram looks like, and I obviously won't go into it in detail, but I'll point out that there's a couple of connectors. Each of these connectors, they're called ZDocs, and they parallel GPIO lanes, and there's 40 of them in parallel on each ZDoc, and you plug an A to D in there, and each A to D can supply 40 gigabits per second of data aggregate across there. And then there are also these things called fast transceivers. In this case, they're called GTPs. And each single transceiver line can do many gigabits per second. It depends on the generation of the transceivers. But there's basically eight sets of four transceivers brought out to connectors here. And out of that, you can, depending on what you install on mezzanine cards, you can put up to 10 gigabit per second Ethernet connectors. So there's sort of an Ethernet standard. And this is what the Roach looks like in practice, and Laura showed this as well. These are 5 gigasample per second A to Ds. There's the FPGA, and there are the 10 gigabit per second Ethernet connectors. So by the way, these are 8-bit 5 gigasample per second A to Ds. So if you consider the throughput through this board, 5 gigasamples per second times 8 bits, that's 40 gigabits per second. There's two of them, that's 80 gigabits per second. And it's not a coincidence that you have 10 gigabit per second at the output as well. So then, where do you find fast A to D converters? So I sort of like this cartoon, which just illustrates that if you Google very high speed analog to digital converters, you don't really get the state of the art in multi-gigasample per second A to Ds, because there doesn't seem to be a killer app for these. They're hidden in research labs. Companies tentatively market them and then withdraw them. You kind of have to know the chief engineer to get a few. And so I thought it useful to make a table of the very high-speed ones available. By the way, I didn't find all of these, but this is the kind of information that Casper shares, apart from sharing specific designs. And I'm going to focus on two of them. One's from a company called E2V. It's a 5 gigasample A to D, and it's what we're designing our present instrumentation around. And it's the one that is used in Laura's digital backend. And then here's a 20 gigasample per second from a company called Hittite, based in Massachusetts. They were just bought out by Analog Devices, so they're going pretty mainstream as well. I'm just going to say a little bit more about both of those. How am I doing time-wise? Okay. So the 5 gigasample per second A to D, that 5 gigasample is pretty fast. And in fact, the way they build this thing is they build on a single chip four 1.25 gigasample per second A to Ds, and they supply a phase shifted clock to each A to D and interleave the samples at the output. Okay? Just to show, so four in parallel, phase-shifted clocks, interleaved outputs, but it turns out that nothing's ever perfect in the world, and this thing is prone to little phase shifts between the A to D, the phased A to D clocks, DC offsets, amplitude errors and non-linearities in the conversion that differ from core to core, and they give you knobs to adjust to optimize that interleave. You wouldn't necessarily expect this, but when we selected this part, we spent a huge amount of time trying to optimize the fidelity. So in this case, converting a 500 megahertz carrier, that's the signal, okay? There's actually a pair of them closely spaced. And you get all these intermodulation products due to imperfections in the interleaving. And there are various specifications that you come up. There's something called spurious free dynamic range, which is the ratio of the peak of the highest signal to the highest of these intermodulation products. And as you do corrections, which go from the bottom to the top, you're able to reduce the size of these and improve the spurious free dynamic range. Basically, this acronym OGP is offset, gain, and phase, three different knobs that you can adjust on each core, and then you can adjust the non-linearity, and you get staged improvements in the performance. And it turns out to be, you know, pretty critical to improve performance. The other thing is, even though a device has a 5 gigasample per second conversion rate, that means the Nyquist bandwidth is 2.5 gigahertz, right? So you'd think you could convert to 2.5 gigahertz, but no, it turns out that the analog input also has a frequency response, and very often it's not as good as you might think, so that just due to the chip alone, you've got about 6 dB of attenuation going from DC to about 2.5 gigahertz. And that's just a limitation when you get into these high-speed devices. And this, for example, prevents you from working in the second Nyquist zone, which turns out to make your block-down converter conversion design more complicated. In radio astronomy, when we're looking at continuum sources, or in general, in fact, our signals are not sine waves, they're actually noise-like. So it turns out that the classic specifications for A to Ds, like effective number of bits, spurious-free dynamic range, signal-to-noise and distortion, those are all sine wave specifications that you derive scanning a sine wave across the band of interest. But if you inject a wideband noise signal, you know, you'll see the tapering due to bandwidth. There's a specification that comes out of an IEEE standard. And the idea is what you do is you put a very deep notch into the analog noise signal. You inject that into your A to D. And then you do a Fourier transform and reconstruct the notch depth. And you find that the notch isn't as deep because you've added noise. The converted signal has noise due to quantization and also due to clipping of the signal.
And so you can do these corrections and improve the notch depth. It doesn't look like it improves that much, but the other thing that happens is you end up with spurs in your conversion band if you don't do this correction properly. So maybe just abstracting a little bit from the details, I will credit Nimish Patel, who worked quite hard on this, and the person who derived all these correcting parameters, figured out algorithms for deriving them, was Bob Wilson, still active in radio astronomy. He's the guy who discovered the cosmic microwave background with Penzias. This is the architecture of a basic CASPA correlator. It's a kind of a generic architecture, and the idea is it's an FX correlator, and you put one of these generic processing engines. This would be potentially a Roach 2. You make an F engine on one side of a cloud here, and an X engine on the other side of the cloud, and basically there's one F engine per antenna, or one F engine per antenna polarization, the key point is you do a Fourier transform here, then you form the baselines in the cloud, and the cloud is a network switch. We actually use generic off-the-shelf network switches to form the baselines, which is a very computational intensive problem traditionally in radio astronomy. And then the X, the cross correlation, is reduced to a cross multiply because now you're in the Fourier domain, and there are computational benefits to this. Just one point that between taking the F and doing the X, there's no possibility of data reduction. You can't integrate or anything. And that's why it's important that this Roach board has a lot of input bandwidth, 80 gigabits per second, and also a lot of output bandwidth. And that traditionally is what you don't find in commercial off-the-shelf FPGA boards, which you can buy at a price. So we've built our own version of this and fitted it to SMA. We call it SWARM, a lot of tortured acronyms. SMA, Wideband, Astronomical Roach 2 Machine. This is that basic CASPA architecture, a 10 gigabit per second Ethernet switch. We actually have F engines and X engines on the same Roach 2, but the switch still has to lie between them conceptually, because whereas an F engine operates on the data just from one antenna, the X engine has to know about every single antenna, okay? Because you've got to form all the baselines in the array in order to do a cross correlation. You've got data going this way, which is antenna data, and data coming back this way, which is all the antennas. So to balance out the data rates,
going into the switch and coming back from the switch,
what you do is you only transmit an eighth of the bandwidth
back to each of the Roach 2s.
5 minutes, good. We had to know that we could fit all this thing into one FPGA. So one FPGA has a lot of stuff in it. So, for example, there's 500,000 logic cells in the FPGA we're using, and about 2016 multipliers. They're 18 bit by 18 bit multipliers, very highly parallel, powerful architecture. And this is a calculation that Rurik Pemyani, who unfortunately couldn't be here today,
because this thing called Swarm goes live tomorrow at SMA, so he's
kind of sweating over that. But basically, there's this concept called
demultiplex factor. So you're sampling at 5 gigasamples per second, but your FPGA can only run at about 200 megahertz. So you have to actually process samples in parallel. And that's what you make many, many parallel paths.
And this equation, for example, is the number of multiply instantiations you need on the FPGA as a function of n, which is the number of points in your FFT, or polyphase filter bank, and d, which is the demultiplex factor. And interestingly, d appears on the outside of the log and on the inside,
whereas n is only on the inside. So it basically says that demultiplex factor, which is essentially bandwidth, is much more expensive computationally than the polyphase filter.
And this doesn't have the
appearance of the Cooley-Tukey FFT. And that was a puzzle to me initially. But it turns out if you take more samples, you have more time to do the computation if you're doing a real-time correlation. So think about that one. I won't drum it home. So Swarm is live on Mauna Kea. Again, I showed this in my site update. That's what it looks like in the Mauna Kea equipment room. It's generating data. The data looks very much like production SMA data. But it's running in a half bandwidth mode presently, because we did the whole logical design in the FPGA at half speed, because it turns out getting these FPGAs to run fast is not easy. So Laura showed you a picture like this of the guts of the FPGA for the DBE, and it had sort of a smattering of blue going kind of diagonally down the part, but Swarm really fills the thing up, right? There's two PFBs, 32K point PFBs. There's a whole bunch of other stuff, delay alignment, phase alignment, packetizing, logic, etc. And that's sort of what the interconnect looked like. Remember, there's like hundreds of thousands of slices. There are little white dots in here.
So there are two PFBs. That sort of consumes most of the package. The FPGA tool uses something called simulated annealing algorithm to minimize. I'm showing these because I know people are interested in this. And it basically, these little white dots are the PFBs spread all over the chip. So we've got two major components, and the placement algorithm pays no regard to functional grouping. It just spreads everything out, and the other PFB is also spread out all over the chip. What you can do is you can go in manually using fan ahead, and here there's a blue line. It's not very clear screenshot. But what I've done is I've put one PFB in this block and the other PFB in this block, and constrained everything in one area. And this is the process whereby human intervention is supposed to improve performance. And I've just zoomed in on it to show how busy it is, and sort of to make the point that, you know, these are block memories. These little ones are multipliers. The bigger ones are block memories. And the generic logic lies in between on the FPGA. And that's zooming in a little closer. And I think the only point I wanted to make here is that just because the whole chip looks blue, if you look inside every slice, only a few components are used. And I still am at 1 minute. So the last thing I want to talk about is we have moved to a faster, we have done development on a faster A to D converter. I don't really think there's anything much faster than this out there available to the radio astronomy community. This is just a little side project that I did using a commercially available FPGA board from Xilinx. It's actually a development board. Typically, these FPGA chips are maybe $10,000 a pop. This is the Vertex 7 series. But they sell these boards for $5,000, $4,995 off the shelf. And it's a higher speed grade part as well. So there's a pricing anomaly there, because they're looking to get things into the hands of people.
And so we built this little A to D board around the Hittite 20 giga sample per second single core device. It's a single core device, which is great. And lo and behold, the damn thing works. This is a sine wave sample, 50 picoseconds per sample, 3-bit resolution. This is the Fourier transform, which has the carrier signal at 510 megahertz and a whole lot of spurs. You get these occasional glitches, which we thought were a fault of our system, but turn out to be things called sparkle codes, which are due to meta stability in the flash converter. So they tell us. We're still investigating. This snapshot came 3 weeks ago. I have a consultant working on this guy called Rick Raffanti. And then you inject noise in this thing, and I apologize that the plot is black filled and ugly. It's just kind of the way it came out. But this is noise. This is basically each bin is 9.76 megahertz. I have to work on the presentation of these. But this is basically the full Nyquist band, 0 to 10
gigahertz, right?
20 gigasample per second conversion. And the noise is, this one's filtered, and this is just the noise generator injected directly in. But the noise is really quite nice and flat, and then rolls off. And then there's also the noise power ratio implicit in the fact that in the stop band, you're about 15 dB down from the pass band, which is about what you expect for noise power ratio for a 3-bit device. Which means it's pretty close to perfect. I have to stop now. Just the point that sometimes adding noise to a sine wave improves matters. And we're going to end. I don't know why this. I don't know if people have seen this one. This is the Dolman et al. 2012 abstract. Sung word for word and posted on the internet. I recommend it. We're going to talk about organization. There's a lot of people. I really sweat over these slides, and I think we need a standardized version of it. But the DSP EHT instrument group is at the top. And
there you are.
And then they're at the bottom there as well. Thanks.
I want one of those Zoom plots from my living room wall. Yeah, that was spectacular. Are there any questions? It's perfect.
It's fascinating.
It was perfect.
Yeah.
Either that or people are getting hungry, one or the other. Shep, if you would work your way up here, the batting cleanup for the Greater Boston team.